Welcome to the Curious Performer Podcast, the podcast for performers who want to grow. Are you ready? Ready to improve your show, to grow your business? Are you ready to build your brand? Then turn up the volume and get ready to hear from some of the best performers in the business. I'm your host, Keith Tussing, and I'll be asking the questions we're all curious about. Today's guest trained at the National Theater of Puppet Arts and at Jim Henson Productions in Manhattan. He is a full-time professional ventriloquist and puppeteer, performing his own scripts, songs, and music. He specializes in curriculum-based assembly programs for elementary schools. He is now in demand as a lecturer at conferences for professional performers and has taught workshops on show building, puppet manipulation, character voices, and ventriloquism. Our guest has performed at the Vent Haven Convention, the Kadabra Conference, CACS, Puppeteers of America Festivals, and at Puppet Guild events. I'm excited today to get the chance to visit with Steve Petra. Steve, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here, Keith.
Oh, so excited to get to visit with you. I'm a fan. Really can't wait to get to hear some of the stories and things like that about you.
Glad to contribute.
Awesome. Well, you know, let's start right at the very beginning. How did you get involved with puppets?
Well, when I was very young, child, I was kind of sickly. I didn't even go to kindergarten. So I grew up that part of my youth in the 50s, when television needed to use up time, and they would hand that over to puppeteers very often. Can you fill 4 hours if we give you enough puppets? But it ends up they were very, very talented people. So there I was sitting in my living room, perfectly content not to be going to school, with surrounded by my drawing pads and books and records and television. I loved television, especially because of the things that were on that offered so much in the world of puppetry. But I, at that stage of my life, I didn't grow up having an outlet for educating myself in puppetry. So I guess when I turned 11, I became interested in music, and then music became my career way before I became a puppeteer, which came later.
How did you make that transition from musician to puppeteer?
I was working in a wedding band. It was a very established band. I was with them for 12 years. It was pretty much the same people. It was a really talented group, very imaginative. We would really do things that other bands weren't doing entertainment wise. We had two trunks full of costumes that we would bring with us. And it was really, it was high on the creative scale. And then somewhere within those years, I married my wife, Jeannie, and she had been a Muppet aficionado. She had this book called Of Muppets and Men. She had some videos of backstage things that were happening. And I became very, very intrigued about this process of how you have this thing on your hand, which is very much like a guitar. And being a left-handed guitarist, like my right hand going up into the mouth and my left hand controlling the arm rods, I just saw that as a very natural thing that I'd be doing with my hands. And so I picked up a puppet that was a mouth puppet that had rods, and I started playing with it. Then I would read that book over and over and over and over. I would study the pictures like they were aerial photos of some kind of like battlefront, where I had to know everything that was going on in every corner of the picture and what these guys were doing. I studied those five Muppeteers who were the core of those early days, and that became my textbook. And plus, watching what I could on video. And then I started working in church. They were looking for someone to help. Actually, when I asked to help, for the person doing it, said, "No one's ever asked to help before, but I need help." And it turns out that myself and my wife became pretty much what was the puppet ministry, because we were creating new characters, we were writing original scripts, we started writing music, we went from 5-minute bits to 15 to 20. To writing little like musicals, and then I found, one of the books I took out of the library, because I took every book out of every library that was in driving distance. Then there was no internet on puppetry. And I just had them stacked up in my living room. I would just go through them. And there was one that I found called Making Puppets Come Alive by Carol Feejan and Larry Engler. And I started looking through the yellow pages. Remember those archival documents that used to exist? And I found the same name that was the author of the book. I said, "That is that possible that she actually lived like within 15 miles of me?" And I called her up. She invited me to her studio. She was 75 years old at the time.
Wow.
I started, my wife and I both started studying with her. She had classes in her studio every week. It was ridiculously affordable. It was like $5. And all of a sudden I went from like on my own trying to figure stuff out to being with someone who had a very, very advanced understanding of theater, of movement, of direction, of stage blocking, of voice work, and just like watching what I was doing, directing me, and eventually insisting that I become a professional puppeteer.
You know, that was so true. I don't think, anybody under the age of 40 would understand how difficult it is to get information back then. I mean, to find books or anything to get your hands on that you could use to learn a new craft.
Right. Especially if you want to delve into some with a greater depth than something that was very specialized.
Right. Right. Well, if you did puppet ministry, then you're probably familiar with the company no longer around called Puppets, Inc. That's who my exposure to professional puppetry was through that company. My brother and I involved in ministry all the way through high school with
puppets.
Was
that company in Texas?
It was in Texas.
Was it a different name than that when it back then?
I think that's what it was, but then it changed later. But yeah, it was there in Texas, and I happened to live in Texas at the time. I mean, from Texas, and
Puppet Productions. That's what I remember.
It. You're right, Puppet Productions. Exactly. We attended several of their seminars. You know, they had guys come through once a year, and
they came to New York as well. I did as well.
Yeah, I love that, and exposure to that was through Jim Henson, which I understand that you have actually had opportunity to be at their production studio.
Yes. In Manhattan, there was a call out for people to attend a workshop. I sent in a video. I got a letter back saying, here you go, show up on this date at this time. We like your work. And I did. There were quite a few people there. But over the course of the first three of the 5 days, that number got whittled down pretty quickly because you had to be able to work on camera on a reverse screen. Not like nowadays you can flip you can do it on your phone. You can flip the screen. So it's like a mirror. It's not like a mirror. And the Muppets, always worked with a regular monitor. They never worked flip scan. And so your brain had to be trained before you got there to reverse everything and be able to function and be able to act, on that screen. 'Cause Jim Henson really created this form of puppetry that was created for television. It was created for the medium, where there was no, before that puppeteers would perform like a proscenium, like they would live and it would be in front of the camera, but he made the camera the proscenium. And then every corner of the real estate of the TV image and the depth became, his landscape. So that really changed how things were going to be done from then on with puppetry in television. It was no longer just here's what it looks like when we do something live. It was for the media. Like Ernie Kovacs had come along and people were doing their vaudeville acts on television. Ernie Kovacs wrote stuff that was for the medium. It was very, very different. He was doing things that no one even thought of, and that's the kind of thing that Jim Henson had done, and he just really kept extending on that and expanding on that for his lifetime.
Yeah, and that's, you know, his early start in television through commercials and things like that. I mean, that, like you said, to fill this amount of time and just to be creative enough to do that, you could see that if you studied Jim Henson and his work, how that progressed. But it was always about being on the TV.
Yeah, he was interested in TV before he was interested in puppets, and his way of getting on television was to become a puppeteer, actually. That was the opportunity that arose. So he made some puppets and filled the call that was out. And it became, he became an artist of note, renown, someone who with unique vision, personality, and temperament that was able to create a team of people to not just execute his vision, but to be part of it themselves. And it was an extraordinary time with that group of puppeteers that there's nothing like it. Disney is now going to be putting those original Muppet shows, which was like one of the heights of that particular group of people at the top of their game. Hopefully they won't 16:9 it and cut off the top and bottom, but we'll see.
Yeah. I would hate to see it changed. I love those shows. You actually own those shows on DVD. Man, his work is something I don't think you could ever replace or change. But now think about that. You know, you went from musician to puppeteer, and then now you do scripted school shows, right?
That's one of the things I do, yes.
Yeah, and tell us a little bit about that. You know, how does that work when you start to create a show for a school setting, things like that?
Well, just to give you a bit of background, instead of like coming up through the ranks and getting to school shows, that was actually our start. I mean, by my wife and I, before I was a ventriloquist, we worked as a puppetry team. So we did more traditional like puppets in a puppet stage. But it was like a 15, 16 foot stage with all these different performance areas in it. And we had like 5, 6, 7, 8 characters within a show. We wrote the music. I scored, you know, like chase scenes because being a musician, I had, you know, that capability as well. And what we were doing in church was we were getting more and more involved. Every time we took on a new project, it would get longer, we'd get more involved, there'd be more music, there'd be more characters, we'd be building stuff, we'd be building props. And our puppetry teacher, Carol Fajan, is the one that actually got the door open for me. A school district came to her, and because she was in the Yellow Pages, and said, "We have a character education curriculum that the faculty has written themselves, and we would like someone to do a puppet show that incorporated the values and ideas and concepts that we've created within our curriculum." And she said, "Well, there's only two people that I know that can write like that, and it's Steve and Jeannie." She gave them our number. They contacted us. We had a meeting. They gave us the curriculum. And they said, "If by the summer, if you can give us some kind of outline of what you're going to be doing, and we'll approve it, and then we'll go ahead." We agreed on a price. And they said, "If this turns out well, we will see that you get into the other schools in the district." It did turn out well, and they did, and the principal did see that we got into the other schools in the district. And we did three shows with the two of us doing that, which is enormous. It was grueling work to do that kind of stuff behind a puppet stage that's that involved and live. And then it was my wife's idea that I become a ventriloquist. We could make the staging of it more contemporary. Kids can be involved from the audience as well on stage instead of the more passive role that the audience played in what we were doing. And that started with me doing the It's a Live show. So that's kind of like the genesis of getting onto a school stage.
And now you mentioned you do other things besides just schools. Tell me a little bit about what you do as far as other venues.
Well, the two venues that keep me most busy until last March, were schools and libraries. I occasionally do birthday parties if I wanted to. It's the problem with, I work in a very confined, like, geographical area. So, I have traveled more in the last 8-9 years, you know, as far as Kansas City, I think I went. Still, a lot of my work is in the tri-state area, New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. If I started doing lower price shows, doing birthday parties, I would have a problem with the same moms that were hiring me for that were paying me $1,100 to do a school show. So there's no, once you're explaining what your pricing is and what the difference is, you're already losing. You're losing the battle. So I just didn't bother creating working myself into a birthday party market. Especially at first, I hated doing birthday parties. I hated it. That's how I started. When I first became an event, I said, well, I'm going to have to break in somewhere with this because this is a really hard thing to do. And it's like, it just takes a certain amount of focus and it takes a certain amount of courage to just get up there and do that. Especially when you haven't perfected all of it. And as I did that, I figured birthday parties, but then I said, I'm in a room with like six. I hate this. I just really, I literally, I hate to use such extreme language, but I couldn't stand it. Couldn't wait to get out. And then I got some offers from people, you know, who were connected with the libraries. Would you consider this? And what I did was I wrote a show that I liked to perform. And I had learned over those intervening years how to really control an audience, like the minutia of controlling an audience, so it would be great for them and great for me. And I was able to put together and execute a show for a smaller audience like that with less, you know, stuff that would be just as entertaining as what I did in the larger venue and just as satisfying for me, where I didn't lose control, because I knew a lot of like puppeteers with that worked in puppet stages, and all their birthday party stories were horror stories because they're behind a curtain. I mean, that's it. The kid's going to do what they want all the time. You're prey. So I had to get out of that mindset and say, well, how can I completely work around that? And the venting was the way to do it, but not the way I was when I started. So I was going back to it with a lot more experience and inspiration. And it turned out now, if I have to do an outside thing, I can do it. If I have to do, you know, if I have to do a firehouse party, I could do it, and I can still get my fee for that. And you know, birthday comes along, and I want to do it, I do it.
Let's go a little bit deeper with you. You mentioned audience control. Can you talk a little bit about how you do that? And is that something that you think is transferable?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything more important than that. And it's really been a learning experience, but for Kadabra, when was it, back in August, I collaborated with Barry Mitchell and Lee Andrews. Actually, they invited me to be part of what they were doing, and it was called The Power of the Pre-Show. And I Barry Mitchell and I talked every day. we work very, very closely. We pore over each other's ideas. It just happened that we were roomed together at the first CACS in California, and we realized, wow, we're probably the only people that can stand each other for an extended period of time. This could be, and the relationship is built from this. But so he invited me to be part of this with him and Lee, and I had already been working on and established a lot of ideas that I was putting into practice. And the way I do it with my DVDs, where everything is like analytical and analytical and then application. So it's not just a theory. I mean, I have this idea. So I'm taking it on stage. Here's what happened. I'll even show you. And And that's the way I approach that. As I discuss, you know, you have to be somewhat of an explorer's heart to excel in this business, because you're dealing with people, and you have to learn. Sometimes you learn from other people. There are things that Jeff Dunham said about working for crowds and how they respond to things as a group, and you have to be able to learn from who's ever got the goods, and you have to be able to observe people in your own situations, in your own audiences, and understand how you can make it better for them. They don't know you're controlling them, and there's not an ounce of cynicism in that. You're really creating a better, more memorable, more satisfying experience for them while they're in the room with you. So pre-show became really important, because I'm sure it's the same everywhere you go, but here in New York, people don't show up on time for anything. So you set up a library show, and you're in the room, you're set up. A few people may come before the scheduled time, but people will come in within the first 15 minutes of the show. So instead of starting my show, I start this pre-show, or I start conversations with people. I have a set of maybe 8-9 routines that are just pre-show routines that all serve a particular purpose in creating a relationship with my audience, where they become, they don't just know who I am. I start bringing them into my world, and that's what I learned from being a puppeteer, not so much a ventriloquist. That puppeteers have a different creative process. It's much more broad. They're creating a universe. They're creating a world, and then they're populating that world, and then they're inviting and the audience into the world. So that's what I'm doing. I'm doing it partially verbally, I'm partially behaviorally, and I'm learning all the nuance. What kinds of words don't work? What kinds of actions work and don't work? What kinds of routines are short and funny and establish me as the person to be paying attention to for the next hour? So with 15 minutes of pre-show, by the time I do my show, the audience is entirely in their seats, they're buckled in, and they're ready for the ride.
That's good.
And there's no greater advantage in the realm of audience control. And I don't say that in a cynical way. It's controlling things the way that you can, like Disney controls things on an amusement park ride. It's the exact same process.
And you think about that as you moved into this as a profession, as you went to, okay, we're learning in the studio, we're taking this out, we've been invited to be a part of the school, and then from that point, this is becoming your profession. What maybe were there early struggles or things you had to work through as you did that?
Yeah. Well, obviously, you don't just like explode onto the scene with lucrative job offers. And so I was working as a musician, and so that was my creative juices were always running. Matter of fact, I started bringing puppets to the weddings that I was doing, and because people started videotaping then, and then they were requesting the puppet, to be on the videotape with the bride and groom, which was an interesting sort of like transformational event. But at some point, I had to like stop the other stuff I was doing and take a leap. So what I did to enhance that transitional time was I took temp work, and I wasn't doing it very long, and I ended up at Nikon camera.
I've owned several.
Well, Nikon's here on Long Island, and the temp agency sent me over there, and it was in a department called Nikon School. And they showed me what they wanted me to do, And it was interesting because I was like, on one side of me had this like this guy like Lindsay Silverman, a guy who used to write for the Nikon magazines, and all these not just like brilliant photographers, but brilliant teachers. And they're just like in the cubicle over here, over there. And I said, well, this is really fascinating. Because I was interested in photography. And so I learned what was going on, and I started swinging with it. I said, I can do this. I can talk to customers, and people want to register. I understand about f-stops and shutter speeds. So after the first day, I went to lunch. And when I came back, the boss, this woman, Ellen, who was running Nikon school, was in my cubicle, and she goes, oh, you came back. I said, what? Why wouldn't I come back? He says, well, the last five people didn't. So I worked out the rest of the week. And I said, well, I really enjoyed this. He goes, well, would you want to do it ongoing? I said, well, I have a little conflict. I'm doing temp work because I'm starting to work in schools, but I don't have enough of a schedule for a living. But I can't turn down school gigs, and they're during the week. She said, what if you give me your schedule at the beginning of every month, and I'll give you those days off if you'll stay. And I did that for 8 years. I didn't even need to do it anymore. I just loved being there. I loved working with the people that I was working with. And I wrote my first school ventriloquist show, It's Alive, How Our Organs Work, on my lunch breaks in the cafeteria at Nikon school.
That's amazing.
One of the photographers that did the advertisements for their product knew what I did because the newspaper did an article on me. And he said, I need to do some shots for our new speed light ads. Could you bring some puppets? And we'll go into the studio here in the building. And I'll use the new equipment and I'll give you credit in the ads, which I did. So there's a Nikon Speedlight ad with this hyper close up of me in the brain, and a couple other shots that they use. So that was something that was really part of the whole creative process for me, because I was in this environment where I can work on my stuff, I can think about my stuff. They had an appreciation for what I did, and I liked, and I got to go to all the seminars that were in New York. So I enhanced my photography skills. And then just around that time, software was coming out for manipulating photography. I was learning how to use that because I was sitting next to the guys that were doing it all the time. And the seminars were now getting more and more dedicated to that. And now eventually to the point where now I do quite a bit of video editing for myself and for others.
Yeah, today's world, very few people understand f-stop and all that. It's all done for you. Earlier in my lifetime, I owned a photography studio and know all about those cameras and Nikon, Hasselblad, all that good stuff.
Yeah.
And lighting. But yeah, that would be a unique opportunity to sit in there. And then obviously a great employee for somebody to say, hey, we'll work with your schedule.
I mean, who's ever heard of such a thing?
That is awesome.
If things go well, you accumulate people in your life that you owe things that you can't pay back.
That's good.
Appreciate.
That is so true. So true. Now, what about if you were talking to somebody today that was just considering stepping into this performance as a profession or puppetry as a profession? What would be your advice to them, Steve?
Well, I think one thing you have to do is you have to look with a critical eye at what are your abilities, what are your talents, and you have to find someone who has a record of accomplishment in those areas that you're interested in. Actually, better than being interested is being obsessed, because that may be the only driving force when your pockets are empty. And having that person assess what qualities you possess, what you need to work on, whether or not it's something you should embark on full time. I mean, I walked into that with Carol, and she actually pulled me over as I was walking into the studio one day for classes, grabbed me by my shirt. She was like 4 feet tall, pulled me down to her nose and said, "You should be professional puppeteer." And then just pushed me into the room. That was it. That was the extent of that conversation. But she was she didn't just do that. She was an advocate for me. And so I appreciated that. I'm kind of loyal when people show an interest in me and help me in areas where I need help. I don't forget it. It's a quality that was passed on from my parents. They were those kind of people. They had a real appreciation and a loyalty for people who had really added to their lives. And I like being like that. I think it's one of the good things I've stumbled on.
Yeah. And like you said, the word you used earlier was somebody that's obsessed with that.
Yeah.
There's a big difference in interest and obsession.
They're not even in the same galaxy.
Yeah. And like you said, when somebody is that deep into something, that's huge driving force within yourself.
You know, you're talking about something that most people don't do and most people can't do. And I'm not talking about me specifically, I'm talking about performing. And so it requires talent because you're talking art forms. And, you know, sometimes we recognize that we're good at something and we look to develop it, you know, and that was like my interest in music became an obsession. And so I'm kind of an obsessive thinker anyway. I don't have hobbies. I'm glad that wasn't one of your questions. Because I do not have hobbies. I just either I'm interested in something to the point where I'm obsessed with it, or I'm indifferent or mildly interested. And so having something that being an obsessive thinker, I think is a quality that I recognize in people who are successful doing excellent work artistically.
And definitely takes that drive to get good at just about anything. And like you said, performers, you read about people, and one of the greatest fears of most people is any form of public speaking. And that's literally what performing is.
Yeah, in this case, that is definitely. And I was a sideman. I played, at one point I was a leader of bands where I was writing a lot of material. But I wasn't ever really like a front person. I branched out when we started doing the costumes and wild stuff at the weddings. I can just jump in because, we had two singers that were in front all the time. I can just jump in I had like five different characters. I would like dress up and go into the audience and start something. But that was like, I can turn it off, turn it on, turn it off. I was kind of protected by the rest of the quality of everything else that was going on. And when you do this, when you're a magician or a clown and you're a solo performer, you're not protected by the quality of anything except for what you produce. I mean, and I'm talking about it like an artistic protection that you're not going to go out there and stink up the room and just be inept and fail. I mean, you're going to fail here and there, but if you're not on a progression of success, and learning and building, then it's probably not for you.
What about a buzzword that we hear all the time in the performance world is branding? You know, you're Petra Puppets and Steve Petra. How do you feel about the idea of branding? How have you branded yourself? How would you describe your brand?
I recognized it to be more important the more I started working, and the more when you encounter obstacles for people understanding the nature of what you do, thereby not perceiving the value of what you do for what it is for an audience, then branding is a solution, because branding, it's a workaround for explanations. You know, if you know people who are marketers know that, if you're explaining, you're not selling. And so there's kind of like a progression, because when my wife and I were performing, we were Petra puppets. But what happens with puppetry in schools, you end up in what we call the puppet ghetto. And it sounds harsh, but it's not. It's just descriptive of what happens with bookings and people's preconceptions of what puppetry is. I mean, Jim Henson had to face it as well. Is that because it was puppets in the name, they relegated it to the very youngest grades.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever leftover money they had. So, and we were developing stuff that was for, you know, up to fifth and sixth grade, and we were getting relegated to, you know, what I was calling the puppet ghetto. We were getting, like the leftover stuff for the youngest. Your value wasn't being perceived. So when I became a ventriloquist, I had to rebrand it. That's why I couldn't leave off the name Petra Puppets, because he had a good reputation. And people knew us within like the school, especially within the school market. And so Steve Petra had to go be, you know, first. Steve Petra and I, Petra Puppets. And a lot of times Steve Petra, we bought stevepetra.com. So that became the website and connected it to petrapuppets.com. And after my first video I did in the studio with a friend of mine, produced it for me, I started doing my own stuff. And I said, well, gee, I need a place to do it. I don't have a studio and I live in a very, very tiny house. So this corner of my basement, which is literally a corner of my basement that I'm talking to you from, became the Petra Cave. And I branded that as where I share educational and insightful material. And it's really the environment that I like to work in. I like chaos. I'm not like Barry Mitchell is very like very structured orderly. And he likes chaos too, but I thrive in chaos. And then out of the chaos, I start bringing ideas and refine them and narrow down how they're going to function within a show, what their purpose is going to be, how can I expand on them, what are they going to be connected to. So people have different process creatively. And that's why I always... Jim Henson continues to be an inspiration, because puppeteers have a different creative process than like ventriloquists. Ventriloquists are very linear in their process. They'll look for a character they like. They'll write a script. They'll have a joke file, and they'll create categories of jokes. Very systematic, and it's linear. You do this, do this, this and that. Then you practice your jokes. And then you have 7 minutes, and that's very linear. But I didn't come from that world. I became a vent after I had been a musician, like for decades, and then a puppeteer. So my creative process has different filters. But I think that's good. People in the vent community, I've really welcomed me. And I realize I do things a little differently, but you know, when you're open to stuff that's different than what you're doing, and if you find that there's quality in it, I mean, if it's some hack doing stuff that, you know, is just like destroying the market, that's different. You know, then you want to go on and, you know, and have a talk with them. But, have you considered being a UPS driver? You know, there's great benefits. There's union. It's a great profession. And but you know, I just look at things in this very open universe. And but I'm not like flaky about it. And there's, if you're going to be entertaining and educating an audience, there's got to be direction and function within everything you do. It's just that I you know, I don't mind getting to that at the later stage of my creative process. Whereas some people do very well starting out that way.
Right, right. Well, you know, and we mentioned puppet productions earlier. My exposure to that early on was very chaotic. I mean, my brother and I just decided, hey, we want to do this. And we were middle school kids, and we started doing it in our garage, just making stuff up and charging kids next door to come watch us. And then...
you charge them right away. Huh?
We knew right away. Only way we could get new puppets was to make some money. So, but with theirs, that was a very, it's just kids throwing this stuff together. And we figured out as we moved on through high school how to create a real show out of that. And like you said, we bring all the pieces together and we're just sitting around brainstorming to create a show. And when I watch your shows and the things that you've done, that's what I see is I see that the word you keep using, world, being drawn together, and we get to step into that. And that's what a puppeteer is trying to do, is draw the audience into that world.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, that's maintained itself as my, like an essential foundation for how I build things. Like, if I'm going to be doing, when I do a school show, what I do is I don't start with jokes. I immerse myself into the content so that I become able to think, not just speak about the content, but think in the world of the content, that those things they're in my room now. Now I have access to these functions of the body. I'm doing a show on biology. I understand things that are essential for the educational part of the show. But then those same things that are essential for the educational part I find what's funny about them. So even the humor gets drawn from the content, and it's different than taking a magic routine and trying to make it conform to something. Not that I'm not like, saying that that's not a good thing or not effective. It's just my way of doing it is more natural for me. And I think it brings about a product on stage that people recognize that has a true originality to it, because it really came out of me and my perception of these words, of these concepts, of what an intestine is, and things that wouldn't ordinarily you find jokes about.
All right. You know, and we talk about the idea of having an audience. You know, in today's world, how do you get, you know, we talked about before the idea that you were stepping into schools because of people you knew, and that still works. I mean, we all get jobs out of things that we know. But in today's world, one of the things I think you have to in some way be involved in is social media. Are you involved in social media? How do you use it? Do you use it?
I use it to an extent. I'm not an expert on it. So there's always stuff that I'm learning. But my Facebook, people are constantly going to my Facebook stuff. I have teachers, librarians, people that have parents that have hired me for their kids in school. And I just, you know, if I think of something ridiculous or stupid or maybe even clever, I just put it on there, and people like it, and they feel comfortable messaging me, conversing with me. You know, we're thinking about this event. You know, it keeps me in their mind. That's pretty much my extent. So actually, I was an early adopter of YouTube. As soon as it happened, I had videos on there, and it's hard for me to get a camera into a school now because of everybody's extremely uptight of anybody taking a picture. Meanwhile, they'll take a picture of their kids doing all sorts of stuff, and it'll be on Facebook everywhere. So aside from it, maybe not making as much sense as people think it does. You know, you have to be compliant with what their restrictions are. So, but at the time I was able to bring cameras and shoot, you know, my It's a Live show, some other shows. And just from like one, I got a gig in Kansas City from a college that had a grant. It was outreaching to rural communities. And they paid me to drive out there and do 10, 15 shows on the basis of a 2-minute video. I mean, they were convinced, and they were paying me four times what they were paying other artists who would fly in with no props and just do something, because that's what they originally offered. And I said, I can't do that. I said, I need all my stuff if you want me to deliver what you just saw and called about. So they got right back and said, okay, well, how much you want? So I said, all right, now I got to figure this out so I don't end up regretting this. And it was a great experience. I mean, I did a couple of shows in a huge auditorium. They bust in kids for that. Then they sent me out to all these schools. You drive, they had a handler that would always meet me at every venue. And you drive for like 45 minutes and there'd be like corn, cows, a silo, and a school. Every time, it was in that order. It was corn, cows, silo, school. And everywhere I went, I thought, you know, here's this New York guy, and very aggressive style on stage. Let's see if it's going to play in Kansas City. And it did. Kids were exactly the same. They loved it. Maybe they loved it more because they never seen anybody act like that. And I wasn't talking like I was from New York, so they didn't even know that was happening. So, I mean, without social media, there are so many avenues that would be completely closed off. So everything that we learn, and how to hone those skills and those tools is to our benefit. And that goes right in with the branding thing. The branding thing is really important, because you can't, you know, if people don't have have you in focus, then you're diminishing your value, and you're diminishing how frequently they might use you otherwise.
That's good. It's really good. What about as a performer, and you look, we've talked about the idea of training and things like that. What are some people you would say, if you're going to be a performer, here's some people you should know?
Well, it depends on which, like if you're going to be a magician, you know, guys that I know that are really, they're not just popular on the lecture circuit, or like Barry Mitchell, Ken Scott. And these are guys that I came across, you know, when I first became event, Mark Wade was this, you know, school show event guy. And he had wrote a book and put, you know, David Ginn at the back, and, you know, there was no internet, so he had to mail away for his catalog. And I kind of learned how to be on stage by myself, by not from ventriloquists, but from magicians. So you don't want to limit yourself to the field, to the precise field that you're in yourself. You want to see there are related art forms that can have a real positive influence over what you're doing, and can be inspiring. It's not just influence so you become like them. It's inspiring so you become more of what of your own potential blossoms as well. So I see guys like Barry and Ken Scott. Tim Sonnefeld is a friend of mine. These people are very, very good at what they do. They're good at how they use their hands, how they think about a routine, and how they present to different audiences. Magicians are end up when a magician takes on a puppet, I've found, this is just me observing, they're very attentive to detail, more so than some puppet people I've known, who feel like, you know, they're still playing in rehearsal sometimes when they're doing something. But magicians are like Sammy Smith. He has this routine with a puppet, rabbit puppet in a hat, and if my puppet teacher Carol Fijan, who would like pretty much excoriate you if you did stuff that was not meaningful movement. She would really have appreciated how he manipulates his puppet character. So you're learning from people in this cross-disciplinary way that's really kind of exciting. For puppets, anything that you can watch that Jim Henson has accomplished, not just how he manipulates a puppet, but what he originated in the kind of mouth movement, the kind of relating to the camera. I've been able to translate some of that to on stage as well, to head position, whether one or two eyes are visible, because it's all about adding dimension to what you know. Now we're doing more stuff on screen. Now we're back to being on screen. Now we're back to a two-dimensional environment again. So adding dimension by how you use your positioning on camera, and if you're using a puppet, how you're operating that puppet and making that puppet relate to the camera is once again relevant, because you're not, you know, I used to say, oh, my shows are all in 3D. Well, not anymore. I'm going back to 2D for a short period. I hope to be back. I hope to recover the 3D very shortly.
Don't we all? We all.
So study, find books that show, don't just show, that people don't just show you what they do, but they show you how they do and why they do. So it becomes a method. So there's a methodology, because there are people who are very talented and good at what they do that aren't necessarily good teachers. So you want to be able to learn from someone who's a good teacher, because then you're less likely to just be imitating them, and you're more likely to be absorbing how they apply the art. And then you'll see, well, this is an art form. The art form isn't some mechanical process. The art form is this thing that you pour yourself into. And then you filter, what's in you filters through it. And that's what makes things different. That's what, you know, makes things original, distinctive. And distinctive is a very important thing to be. And go back, you know, you can't get enough of that branding thing, because that keeps coming up.
Yeah.
Because if you're not thinking about it, it doesn't matter, because all of your customers, that's how they're thinking. They're not thinking that they're thinking that, but that's what they're thinking. I think.
What about continuing education? You just finished being a part of CACS, and that was a lot what you were talking about, the cross different art forms. You know, CACS had several different things. We had puppets, we had magic, we had all just kinds of stuff on there. But as far as continuing education, what would be something you would recommend? Conventions, books, videos?
All of those. Some may be more appropriate to you depending on what you're doing than others. But I've tried to get to puppetry festivals. I used to go to more of than I do now. But I need to recharge my puppet batteries every so often. So I need to go to something with puppeteers, because, like I said before, the creative process is different, and I need those batteries recharged on that part of my functioning. I pretty much go to the ventriloquist convention every year. CACS I've participated in. I was at the first one, and I was able to teach at the recent one, but I'm also attending it. And I'm watching all this, or I'll go back and watch stuff that I missed. And I'm studying and I'm taking notes and I'm learning. And, you know, people like Mark Daniels and Tammy and for ventriloquist Mark Wade, they've done the legwork for you. They've collected all these people that are not just accomplished and unique within the field, but they're good teachers. They know how to impart to you the value that they've accrued, and that's, I mean, I don't know how you ignore something like that, because that didn't always exist. And you can see it, if all of your learning is on the internet, you're gonna get an overload. And what happens when you're overloaded is nothing. You have a lot of input, and you have colors, and you have lines, and you have depth, but nothing takes shape. You know, it could, things may never form because there are too many options all the time. And focusing on an instructor that is worth your time and attention, it pulls away some of the extraneous stuff and gets you to focus on something. Because if you can't build in your little pieces your skills, your abilities, then you're not being specific enough with your improvement. And when you're on stage, when you're a performer, a professional performer, there's a specificity to the quality that you bring. You know, even to be funny, like Jerry Seinfeld always says, when he's honing a line, if it's not specific enough, it's not funny. So there's something to be said for just getting down and finding the specific way of handling a coin, the specific way of moving a mouth and eye contact with a puppet, you know, the specific way of creating a balloon sculpture. Because if you look at great artists that throughout history, they're recognizable because of the specific things that they do, that don't just demonstrate their skill, but also connect with an audience, with a viewer, with a listener.
Very good.
It's art. You know, this is art. You know, it's sometimes you get dissuaded from thinking of that because you got so much of the business thing going on that you have to deal with, and you got to show up and you got to set up your stuff, and then the kids don't come in the room on time, and the teachers are on their phone. But it's still an art, and the more you proceed as an artist, two things happen. You win over the audience artistically, and I'll go back to Jerry Seinfeld. He said he was asked, how do you follow something like Seinfeld? He says, you don't. You don't become a star, you remain an artist, and you create something else. And so those are the two things. You win people over artistically, and you continue to be an artist. Instead of how do I recreate what I did before being the essence of everything you do next.
Good. As we get ready to wrap this up, Steve, I want you to think about, and we've talked a lot about these things, and repeating something we've already said is not bad at all. But if you were speaking to a group and said, hey, here are the top three things that I think are critical to being a successful performer, what are those?
Practice, but you have to practice correctly. So learning to practice correctly comes from someone who can teach you how to practice. Otherwise, in everything, coin manipulation, in puppetry, if you don't practice correctly, you're just learning your mistakes. So practice, preparation. I like complicated music, man. I used to go I'd get in the car with my friends, and we would drive all the way upstate to go see Frank Zappa because the music was so complicated and tight and done with such expertise that it was very satisfying for this group of people that I was with and myself. But there's no way of doing that without extraordinary preparation. And that's a good example because, you know, you can practice, but you've also got to prepare. You got to prepare for everything that you're going to be presenting on stage. And you've also got to once you're practiced and once you're prepared as a performer, if you're performing live, you've got to be open to what can happen with an audience that might be unique to that performance, and that takes not just an awareness. It takes some experience so that you don't add the third P and panic. Because when something happens that's unique to that audience, and you can turn it into something that is part of the entertainment, and the audience becomes part of your show, they remember that forever. Because they know, hey, that couldn't have happened in the last show. That just happened when we were there. And they want to tell people about something like that. So I've learned to become open to that. I don't have a nifty little word for it, but it's something that when I'm in an audience, something that I've always treasured. And it's something that I've seen my audiences. And you know what? They give you all the credit for being a skillful and brilliant performer because you were able to take advantage of something that just flew by and could have gone out the window, but you grabbed it. But most important, the other thing I want to add, I'm going to add a fourth thing.
Okay.
And I picked this up from Patti LuPone, and there's a P in her name, so we'll add another P to our list. And I watched her talking to theatrical students, you know, musical theater. That's what she does. And she had sat this girl down and she said, and she's in a theater. They're on the stage. There's all these empty seats. She says, see out there, what those people that come here, this is not you doing your art. You're creating something. You're crafting all that preparation, all the practice, all the things that we said up to this point. It's what you use to make something for them. And when they come here and you're giving it to them, it goes, here, I made this for you. And I always feel that. I always have this sense that with the audience, I made this for you. I'm going to go and you're going to take, you can take it. You can take it back with you because I made this for you. And that's the sense that I have when I'm creating material from the beginning of the research until the performance itself, that it's a present. It's a gift to them.
And that is so true of live experience, a live piece of theater, a live piece of art, that it's that moment of experience that they get to take with them and that may never, ever happen again.
Yeah.
That's the uniqueness of what we do.
Exactly. That's very, very well put.
Hey, Steve, I've used your DVDs and things like that for quite a while. I'd like everybody to know how they can get access to your material. So share that with us.
Well, on my website, there's a store. If you go to stevepetra.com/store, I have four DVDs available. My first is Let's Get Visual. And there's a Let's Build a Show. There's my lecture DVD, and From the Petra Cave, which is a collection of six or eight different subjects that I talk about, and it ranges from turning a running gag into a galloping gag to how to write material for a show that is instantly appreciated and involving the audience. So all those are there on the site. And if someone's listening to your podcast here, if they want to message me on Facebook, just Steve Petra on Facebook, send me a message. The password is Keith. If they write Keith at the beginning of the message and they have looked at my product page, give me a list of what you want. I'll give them the Keith discount.
That's great. That's great. I can't say enough about Steve and his material. I've used it. I would encourage you to get the DVDs and take a look at that. We talked about earlier the difference in being just a performer or being a performer that's a great teacher. And I will tell you that Steve is a great teacher, and you cannot lose by getting his material.
Thank you.
Well, Steve, man, I have enjoyed getting to visit you, get to talk with you a little bit. I am going to remain jealous of the fact that you got to go to the Henson production studio. That would have been a dream of mine. But, hey, I love what you do. I enjoyed visiting with you, and thanks for taking the time to do that.
This was great fun. Thanks for inviting me, Keith.
You bet. If you like what you've been hearing on this podcast, I invite you to go wherever you're listening to this episode and leave us a comment or review. Tell me what you love about this episode, or better yet, tell me what you want to hear more of in the future.